This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This time, we have what just might be the best bits and pieces episode so far. I say that because we have a huge variety of aviation topics from the co-hosts, our contributors, and you, our listeners. Get ready to hear about the Yankee Air Museum, a couple of new aviation podcasts, the DC-3, the loss of astronaut Bruce McCandless, a student pilot's first solo, the passenger experience, a Sikorsky weekend, a Rwanda flying incident, how we make this podcast, a Klingon, an Oz desk report, and a lot more. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 484 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and this is a bits and pieces episode to span the holiday season at the end of 2017 and kicking off 2018. Instead of our usual format, we have a collection of recordings from the co-hosts and from our listeners and contributors. It's all aviation, and there's a lot of it. So if you're ready, let's get started. David Vanderhoof met with Kevin Walsh, the executive director at the Yankee Air Museum, for a conversation and walkthrough. The museum is adjacent to the Willow Run Airport in Belleville, Michigan. Here's David and Kevin.
Well, I've had an amazing day here in Detroit. Now, most people know that I am in a museum geek, and I have spent the day here at the Yankee Air Museum with incredible hospitality. I think I have a new love of a new museum. But I'm here with Kevin Walsh, who's the executive director of the Yankee Air Museum. Kevin, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We had an amazing day. I came here to look at your newest acquisition, the EC-121, or the WV-1, depending upon who you, whether you're Navy or Air Force.
Right.
But I also got to stumble into your tour for your new members. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the museum. What did your new members see?
Well, we look at any members as part of our family. And it's important that they understand what we are because, of course, they can be stewards for our museum, and they're very important stewards for our museum. But we're so dynamic and have so many different aspects of our museum that we started new member orientation so that our members can learn about everything that we do, not just the vintage airplanes that we fly, the capital project that we're doing, the oral histories, how we preserve artifacts, how we take care of textiles, see our docents in action and all the different facets of the museum that we have. It's important that we do some type of orientation to show people so they can go out and spread the good word about all the things that we're doing here and what our great volunteers are doing.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of the museum. You gave a presentation today. How did it start? We're a phoenix coming out of a tragedy. And something that I'm really excited about, which is your newest acquisition for a new facility. So
sure.
Let's start with, what would our listeners want to know about the Yankee Air Museum?
Sure. Well, the museum's been around for 36 years, founded in 1981, like most museums, founded by aviation enthusiasts, a group of guys getting together, filing for a nonprofit, and starting to amass a bit of a collection of airplanes and other artifacts. That collection grew regionally for many years. And then our biggest setback, obviously, was October 9th, 2004, when an indeterminable fire swept through our hangar, taking out 35,000 artifacts, 8 airplanes. We were able to pull the flyable aircraft from the burning building. Volunteers that had just returned on one of our flyable airplanes pulled as much as they could out of the building, and we were basically starting over again. And we had that tough decision. It would have been a lot easier to sell the airplanes and pack up, but we decided to fight. We, as a board, as a member-based organization, we decided to carry on. And it took us 6 years to get to an intermediate building, the building that we're in now. But that allows us public programming. It allows us our educational programming. It allows us to be a presence and a destination point again. And that was super important for our evolution, because the next step that came was the ability for us to save a portion of the World War II Willow Run bomber plant as our future and final home. And that's really what's in the crosshairs now, is fundraising for this capital project. We saved 144,000 square feet of this Willow Run bomber plant before the rest of it was torn down, but it needs $20 million worth of renovation. So we have a big, big goal in mind. We are already $8+ million in cash and in-kind raised. So we're getting near that 50% mark, and that will be the new home of the Yankee Air Museum in about 3 years.
And the Yankee Air Museum is one of those unique museums that you've got a very elaborate static displays. You also have a traveling exhibit, or multiple traveling exhibits. Tell me about the flying portion of the museum.
Yeah, we believe that for the aircraft that you know, that can be made flyable, we should fly them. The ones that make sense to be, you know, made flyable, that we fly them. There's nothing more to immerse someone in history than a flight aboard a B-17 or B-25. Or our C-47. We have a Waco biplane. That doesn't fit into the vintage category. What that does is fit into the category of just inspiration and people loving aviation for no other reason than just the gift of flight. You know, it's something that we love to do. We love to tour them. We love to take them around the country. We love to show them off. But again, we want to make sure that, you know, not everything is just behind a rope with a placard. You know, when you're sitting on a B-17 or a B-25 and the engines start, it's a visceral experience. You know, and there's no museum interactive display that will ever equate to you know, a B-25 on full power taking off down the runway and you sitting where, you know, our American heroes have sat. And that's sort of, you know, one of the things that's been key to our museum is keeping the aircraft flying. And that makes us different and rare.
And you have a B-17, a B-25, a C-47, and like you said, the Waco.
Yep.
And we toured your facility. I have to admit, it was kind of awe-inspiring seeing these aircraft torn down for the winter as we're sitting here in upstate Michigan and with the snow falling and a little chill in the air. But it was nice being in a hangar with those aircraft. It's not, you get used to seeing them on an air show.
Yeah.
Full, you know, revved up. There was something spectacular and nice about seeing them with cowls off and the engines exposed and them sort of going through their hibernation for the winter. Mm-hmm. And on that side of the museum, besides your hangar for the active aircraft, we then toured your newest acquisition, which, when you said 3% of a factory, you've saved how much square footage?
We saved 144,000 square feet of the original 3.5 million square feet that was the Willow Run bomber plant. And of course, historically significant spot. We often talk about those on the front lines. We talk about our veterans that have served. But we often forget about the home front, the importance of the home front, and the manufacturing capability of America that won World War II. We outproduced, we outtrained our enemies. And if it wasn't for the production capabilities, in particular through the auto industry, because the auto industry techniques spread all over the nation. And that's important to note, that it was a point in time where technological advances in manufacturing were just coming out on a daily basis. And to be able to turn out a bomber every 55 minutes, no one would be able to do that. We often say that no battles were fought there, but a war was won, and that is in essence what the bomber plant was about.
on Airplane Geeks, we love supporting women in aviation. You had a bunch of volunteers today that were women, and some young girls that mm-hmm. were just, right? But Willow Run also has something really dramatic about women in aviation mm-hmm. and women in industry. Tell us a little bit about how Willow Run falls in with women.
Sure, absolutely. Of course, in World War II, we saw the introduction of women in the industrial workplace. And the Willow Run bomber plant here was no different. By the end of World War II, half of the workers at Willow Run were women. And they held all various positions within the factory also. Management roles, leadership roles, etc. And of course, one of the most famous Rosies to work in the United States was Rose Will Monroe. Who was the subject of a war bond film by a Canadian videographer. And at that time, it nicknamed her Rosie the Riveter. So we feel that, you know, the Willow Run bomber plant was really Rosie's factory, home to Rosie the Riveter. Not the image of Rosie the Riveter, but the terminology of Rosie the Riveter, because it was, if it wasn't for the women in the industrial workplace, the Willow Run bomber plant wouldn't have worked. You know, so it was a very important change socially in America when women went to work in these plants. And later on, that social impact was felt with women entering the workplace after World War II, after the families had grown up. Women had gotten that feel and that empowerment and that taste of work and earning a paycheck and contributing to something big. And so we often think of the women's movement as this some sort of radical social economic change. In a lot of it, when you talk to the original Rosies, the women who were in the factories in World War II, they just simply wanted to go back to work after the family had grown up and the kids had moved away. There wasn't as much radical change. Of course, outspoken in history, there was a very few number of very outspoken individuals. But, that paved the way, that introduction in World War II in the industrial workplace paved the way for, obviously, women in the workplace and further growth 20 years later.
So let's dovetail a little bit. Tell me about your history in aviation. How did you suddenly get to where you are as executive director? I'm envious. You have a job that I would be a dream job for me as a historian. But you've got a small background in aviation.
Just a little one. First off, I do this job for free, but don't tell anybody. Kind of the love for aviation began with my father, who was an air show producer in Canada. In 1974, he created the London International Air Show, which ran for 23 years consecutive, one of Canada's largest military air shows. So at 5 years old, I was immersed in the air show world. And as the air show grew, I became more and more immersed in that component. After the retirement of my father, I thought I was done with aviation, and I moved on to a very successful medical career in sports medicine, and moved to Michigan. Worked 15 years as a director of sports medicine here, but all the while I kept my finger in by volunteering at the Yankee Air Museum. And I literally walked in the first day as a volunteer, joined as a member, and for months I just swept the floors because I just wanted to be around the airplanes, just wanted to be next to them. Didn't want to work on them, didn't want to fly in them. I just wanted to contribute. And lo and behold, you hang around long enough and people start to learn. You've got some skill sets and they ask you to do a few things. And all of a sudden, I was serving on the board of directors. I formed the Thunder Over Michigan Air Show with Michael Luther in its early days back in 1999. And then after the fire, I was on the board of directors. And then in 2012, they offered me the position of executive director. About that time, the medical field started to feel a little bit like work. I thought maybe it's time for a change. And here I am back 100% into aviation in producing the Thunder Over Michigan Air Show and then obviously executive director of the Yankee Air Museum.
I'm jealous. I really am. That brings us to Thunder Over Michigan, which is your largest fundraiser for the year. Mm-hmm. what would people expect? Why do they want to come to Thunder over Michigan?
Well, it's been our mantra to make sure we're not like other shows. We try very, very hard, and we kind of feel we fail on years where it looks like another show. We were kind of forefront in a lot of gatherings. Back in 2007, we had Mitchell Madness, and it was the first time that more than a few B-25s had gotten together. It was 15 B-25s here, and that was a large number. Now with the Doolittle reunions, obviously see that more frequently. In 2005, we had the Gathering of Fortresses, the B-17 gathering. We had 8 B-17s, and again repeated that in 2010 with another 8 B-17s, tying our world record. We attempt to bring gatherings like that. This past year in 2017, we had the world's largest paratroop drop since World War II, bringing 6 C-47s from all over the country that were jump capable with multiple jump teams to make that happen. Unfortunately, because of the winds on Sunday, Monday, the performance didn't go off, but we did set a world record on Saturday. We spend a lot of time and effort and money to make sure that we have some sort of a theme of something that you won't see anywhere else, a gathering of airplanes or some type of special salute. And that's kind of the premise behind Thunder. If we're not kind of challenging ourselves, shame on us. But some of our most popular themes, Bombertown USA in 2015 was incredibly popular, and even odd themes like Helotown USA, where we celebrate the helicopter, in its evolution. But those are the things that make Thunder different, I think, that, again, we're constantly striving to say, okay, that has never been seen with this. And even this year with the Blue Angels, not vintage military, of course, but John O'Connor's Blue Angel Bearcat had never flown with the Blue Angels. So we made sure that that was something that occurred here. Although at a pre-media type event, we did have the Blue Angel Bearcat fly with Blue Angel 5 and 6 after one of the practices, because we think it's historically significant that that airplane in those markings has never flown with the current Blue Angels. By the way, they use as the current backdrop of their convention booth at the International Council of Air Shows convention this year. that particular photograph that was taken in Ypsilanti.
It's pretty amazing. Now, you and I have had a discussion about themes, the museum having themes and having focus and being curated. And my biggest pet peeve as a historian is just a bunch of airplanes with tags. And you've talked about focus and stuff. And we're talking about a facility that built B-24s. Mm-hmm. You have a legacy of B-17s and C-47s and World War II vintage. And we were out in the snow looking at two things. One was a B-52D. Mm-hmm. The other one was your latest acquisition, which is why I and my cohort, Dave, drove out here, and that would be the EC-121. So how does the EC-121 come here, get here, and suddenly become part of your collection?
Well, when it was first offered to us by the Navy, the unfortunate closing of the Chanute Air Museum, we had to take a step back because it's a big airplane, we had to make sure that it fit in a storyline. We cannot take an aircraft just to take an aircraft. Just because Kevin Walsh likes it, the collections committee doesn't say yes. For example, as we move forward, our storylines are going to be things that are going to have interest to the general public. So instead of talking about reconnaissance aircraft is not a very exciting topic. However, rebranded and marketed as high spying everyday espionage, now you have something that you can really build an exhibit around. And an EC-121 or Willie Victor fits perfectly into high spying everyday espionage. And the story of how many of these were involved well before the due line and what mission they played and who were they watching and who were they spying on? Not reconnaissing, but spying on. And that's sort of the approach that we're taking for future stories and the new museum to make sure that we are telling stories not just about the airplane, but about the visionaries, the aerospace advancements, and again, we have to think about the attention getters that will have people coming back again and again. If you do the four P's, you know, place, plane, put, placard, there's nothing repeatable and enjoyable about that. So you better have some type of interactive type activity to bring people back, to say, hey, let's go to the museum today. Just like they say, let's go to the zoo. If you're a zoo member, you'll go 5, 6, 7 times a year because there's something about the zoo that it's entertaining each time you go. So that's the same type of philosophy we have with the new museum.
I said to you privately, and I'll say this to our listeners, we were over in a hangar that was cold, falling apart, not necessarily, but very vintage and very scarce. And like you said, a construction site. And some aircraft in there scattered. And if it was another museum, I sort of would feel hopeless. You go in there and you go, oh no, this is not going the right way. I have never, ever been in a building like I was over in Willow Run where I was, oh my God, the potential. It's there. Your energy, Ashley's energy, the volunteers' energy that were on the tour today is incredibly powerful. And the space is just amazing as far as I'm concerned. It's a piece of history that I've always wanted to see. And it's a piece of history that's important. And I want to thank you for you and your team for presenting a awesome potential space. And I'm looking forward to interacting with you guys a lot because I came away with a real powerful experience today.
Sure.
And I want to thank you. And you guys have got it figured out. I think when Yankee Air Museum changes names, and that name will be
the National Museum of Aviation and Technology,
it's going to be awesome.
Thank you. Well, we're looking forward to it. We have a little ways to go, but like I said, it's in the crosshairs. We know exactly where we're going. There is no plan B for us. It is renovating the World War I bomber plant and making it the National Museum of Aviation and Technology.
So, if our listeners want to find out more about the museum and how to interact with you guys, how to become a volunteer, how to become a contributor, how do they do that?
So, the Yankee Air Museum website, very robust, well-kept up website, yankeeairmuseum.org is the website to go to. If you specifically want to learn more about our campaign and the bomber plant, savethebomberplant.org. You can get to savethebomberplant.org from the museum website. If you want to go directly to learn a little bit more about the campaign itself, savethebomberplant.org is where you go.
And Thunder Over Michigan in August of next year?
Yep, August 25, 26, headlining the United States Air Force Thunderbirds, but more importantly, bringing some of the heavy hitters from World War II, both bombers and fighters and transports and trainers, and really getting back to the roots of where Thunder began.
Well, Kevin, I appreciate it. Thank you for a wonderful day, and thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. You can find the Yankee Air Museum at yankeeairmuseum.org. Igor Sikorsky III has been our guest on Airplane Geeks twice, first in episode 144 and then again in episode 243. He and his wife Karen run the Bradford Camps in the North Maine Woods. It's a beautiful, peaceful location on Munsungan Lake in an area where you can fish, hunt, hike, boat, or just hang out and relax like my wife and I did a few years ago. Each year, Igor conducts his Sikorsky Seminar Weekend where he shares the history of his grandfather through photos, videos, and even Sikorsky family speakers. You can immerse yourself in Igor's Russian years in aviation, his large Pan Am flying boats, and of course his helicopters. Igor has quite a collection of historical documents and memorabilia. One of my favorite moments was holding in my hands Connecticut State Helicopter Pilot License Number 1, issued to Igor Sikorsky. So watch the website at bradfordcamps.com for the 2018 Sikorsky Seminar dates. And if you can't make that weekend, consider spending time at the camp just relaxing, enjoying nature, and benefiting from the warm company of Igor and Karen Sikorsky. Note that the camp is very remote, and there are two ways to get there. You can spend several hours driving on unpaved logging roads, or you can fly to the lake in a seaplane. Either way, it's an adventure. Our main man, Micah, needs no introduction. He frequently contributes to this and other aviation podcasts. For this episode, he sends us a story he calls My Dream Machine. So let's listen to Micah.
If this little piece airs when I think it will be posted January 3rd, 2018. Happy New Year, everyone. The New Year brings about many thoughts. These particular thoughts, though, were inspired by regular listener Sort Baker, in the Netherlands. Since meeting him in Farnborough, July 2016, Sort and I continued to be in touch through Twitter and the Airline Pilot Guy podcast chat room. He works with the Dutch Dakota Association, also known as DDA Classic Airlines, or just DDA. If things go as planned, sometime soon, DDA will be bringing a DC-3 back to life to become a sightseeing passenger airliner. Like the Wright Flyer, the Douglas DC-3 also first flew on December 17th, but 32 years later in 1935. It's amazing what happened in those three decades. The DC-3 had a cruise speed of 207 miles per hour, a range of 1,500 miles, a service ceiling of 23,200 feet, and a climb rate of 1,130 feet per minute. With those kinds of numbers, many say the DC-3 was the first real airliner, and it certainly revolutionized air transport. Now, of course, I have no doubt that you all remember that I have many favorite aircraft. Yeah, I'm fickle that way. My love of airplanes is Catholic. That's with a lowercase c. When used that way, the word means universal. But even with my Catholic taste and fickle nature, I must say that the DC-3, without a doubt, has been one of my true loves for over 50 years. I remember the first time I saw a DC-3. It was in the 1945 John Ford film, They Were Expendable, starring Robert Montgomery, John Wayne, and Donna Reed. Although I've got to say, my favorite actor in that film is Ward Bond. He's always been outstanding in just about everything he's done. Ford Apache, The Maltese Falcon, The Grapes of Wrath. No, but that's another story. Anyway, the first time I saw They Were Expendable, I must have been about 7 or 8 years old, and watched it, as I did many old films, with my father, Lou. At the end of the film, I saw a plane fly in to take Robert Montgomery and John Wayne to safety. The aircraft was sleek, twin-engined, looking like, as Max Flight once said, quote, just what an airplane should look like, unquote. It was love at first sight. I asked my dad, what kind of plane is that? He said, it's a C-47. My dad told me the C-47 was a cargo and troop-carrying airplane, and that while he was in theater in Europe, he flew on them many times. A few weeks later, my dad took me to the movies. Yes, we went out to the big screen together to see The Longest Day, a top-notch flick I highly recommend. The Longest Day was filled with C-47s. From then on, I was looking for C-47s in every film I ever watched. 3 or 4 years later, I was visiting my cousin Mitchell on Long Island in New York. He was in the Civil Air Patrol, and he took me to Islip MacArthur Airport to show me around. My Aunt Martha, Mitchell's mom, dropped us off at the airport and said she would be back to pick us up in a couple of hours. Back then, airports were pretty open spaces, and even kids like us could pretty much just walk out on the tarmac at any time. I remember approaching the flight line, and I saw, parked right in front of me, a C-47, the first one I ever saw in person. I said to my cousin Mitchell, look, that's a C-47, but he corrected me. No, he said, that's a DC-3. Mitchell took the time to explain the difference between a DC-3 and C-47, but it didn't matter to me. I was in love. We walked right up to it, got right under its nose and looked up. Remember, I couldn't have been more than 11 or 12 years old. I was a kid, and the plane looked immense to me. I remember Cousin Mitchell's words as he looked up with me. He said, "Look at all that surface area." We stood in front of that DC-3 for maybe 30 minutes and spent the rest of our time there walking around it, inspecting it from nose to tail, wingtip to wingtip. The 2 hours we had at the airport felt like 10 minutes, and then it was time to go. I didn't get close to another DC-3 again for over a decade. This time it was in Athens, Ohio, at the Ohio University Airport. The avionics department at Ohio University had been gifted two DC-3s by the federal government. One was permanently grounded, but the other was flown as a testbed for electronics. I never got to see them while an undergraduate. I didn't have any way to get out to the airport. But when I returned to Athens, Ohio, as a graduate student, I would visit them regularly. If you go to a map and look at the area in and around Athens, Ohio, you can see that it's pretty much of a dead spot for aircraft. It would drive me nuts not being able to look up and see an airplane in the sky. It was a major event when one was visible. As a graduate student, about every 2 weeks, I would drive out to what was an almost deserted airport to visit the DC-3s. Most times they were locked up in their hangar, and I had to peek at them through a window. Occasionally, one would be outside, and I could walk right up to it. But once, I was invited inside and got a chance to climb up into the cockpit. It was only for a minute, but what a thrill. A few years later, I took a job in Pueblo, Colorado. Part of my job responsibility was running a summer youth hostel and conference center. The location of this facility overlooked the Pueblo Memorial Airport, and it was wonderful for plane spotting. If you want to hear more about my experiences in Pueblo, check out my story, Pueblo, A Geek's Dream, which appeared on Airplane Geeks episode 313. Back then, the Pueblo Memorial Airport also played host to the Great Colorado Air Show at the end of every summer. I attended it 1 year with my father when he flew out from New Jersey to visit me. After that, I just watched the acts from my perch high on the hill that looked perpendicular to runways 8/26 and parallel to runways 17/35. 1 year, the conference center hosted a group of skydivers that were going to perform at the air show. They were a large group, and being the airplane geek I've always been, I befriended them, asked about their act, how long they were doing it, and what they would be jumping from. They told me they hired a DC-3 and it would be coming the next day. They invited me down to the airport to watch them dirt dive and do their practice jumps. I'd never seen anything like that before and was thrilled to take part, but what I really wanted was a ride in that DC-3. The pilot checked in the next morning. I was at the desk and made sure he got the best room we had. I told him what a fan I was of the DC-3 and that I would be coming down to the airport later in the day to watch dirt dives and practice jumps. I asked him if there was any chance I might be able to get a ride on the DC-3 during one of the jumps. His response? "Well, come on down. We'll see what we can work out." I was ecstatic. Later that day, I went down to the airport and was welcomed by the group. I had no familiarity with skydiving. I was taught about dirt diving and watched everyone count down and roll around the tarmac on their bellies on wheeled carts. They would count down, start, count up, go into formation, count down again, and break off. Then the group would critique the dirt dive and try again. It went on for a couple of hours until they were ready to make a practice jump. Now, I wish I remembered the pilot's name. I do recall he had an incredible number of hours in many different types and had a U.S. Air Force background. The way he looked, as well as the way he walked and talked, a modest yet swaggering style, he sort of reminded me of Sam Shepard. During the dirt dives, I checked in with him, asked what the chances were of flying in the DC-3. He said they looked pretty good, but he needed to check with the FAA inspector. I didn't know why a conversation with an FAA inspector was necessary. Still don't, for that matter. But when the inspector came along to check in and look at the aircraft, I do remember him asking the pilot if he had his own parachute. His exact words? "You got a rig?" The pilot picked up a black rig and walked with it to the aircraft as they went on the inspection tour. The inspector left, and the pilot said to me, "Not this time, but hang around. We should be able to get you on for the next jump." A few minutes later, the skydiving team climbed on board, and they took off for their first live practice of the day. It was just terrific to watch those engines start up from so close by, hear the roar of those Pratt & Whitney R-1830 twin wasps, and feel the breeze they kicked up. I watched them taxi out, take off, and climb. I lost sight of it for a while, but then the next time I saw it, it wasn't just it was them. That DC-3 looked like it was giving birth to 30 or so little ants as the skydivers jumped out and started their free fall. I was so enthralled with the skydiving that I lost track of the aircraft until it landed. The skydivers touched down, grabbed up their chutes, and came back to the practice area where they repacked and discussed the dive. Then they started dirt diving again, making corrections based on what happened in the air. They told me they would only be doing 2 or 3 dirt dives this time, and then go on another practice jump, their last for the day. Trying not to be a pest, but also not wanting to be forgotten, I asked the pilot what the odds were that I would be able to come along this time. He said he hadn't forgotten about me, but needed to run it by the FAA inspector when he returned. The conversation between the pilot and the FAA inspector was interesting, to say the least. The pilot pointed at me and said, "Can I bring him along in the right seat?" The inspector replied, "He got a rig?" The pilot said, "On the plane." And the inspector replied, "Okay." Well, that was great news. I was going to fly in a DC-3, in the right seat, no less. But I had no idea why I needed a parachute. In fact, I still don't. But I did know there was no parachute on the plane for me. I also knew that even if there was one, I had no idea how to put it on, let alone use it. No matter, I was going to fly in a DC-3. The pilot walked me over to the plane and got in with me close behind him. I walked up the incline to the cockpit and had to climb over a great big green oxygen bottle about 4 feet long and mounted lengthwise in the fuselage with a valve in the opening of the cockpit door. Attached to that valve were a bunch of hospital-style clear soft plastic oxygen masks connected with long clear tubing. It looked rather jury-rigged to me. Maybe that's what the FAA inspector had wanted to see. The interior of the DC-3 was hot. I mean, it had to be at least 95 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 35 Celsius. Remember, it was the middle of the afternoon in August in the high desert of Colorado. The pilot had his window open, and I slid mine back, too, trying to catch what little breeze there might be. I was sweating like in a sauna and was soaked with perspiration. The skydivers climbed on board, and the pilot began the startup procedures. He had me call clear out of my open window and started the right R1830. Then he started the left one. We taxied out and took off. The skydivers were packed in behind me like cattle. One of them, directly behind me, was fiddling with the oxygen, and within a few minutes he handed me a mask. It seemed a bit strange to be starting the oxygen so early in the climb, but then I remembered. We had a 5,000-foot head start. Pueblo was at 5,000 feet mean sea level. The other thing I realized, I was cold. The stiff breeze in the altitude had pretty much dried out my sweat-soaked shirt. I reached and closed a window. We climbed to about 20,000 feet. It was a long climb. Remember, the DC-3 has a service ceiling of only 23,200, and a climb rate is 1,130 feet per minute, so it took about 15 minutes to get to the drop altitude. I was breathing through the mask, happy to finally be flying in a DC-3 for my first time. We reached the drop point, and the pilot shouted, "Go!" The skydivers all started shouting, "Go! Go! Go!" And then they were gone. By the time I turned around to see them exit, the plane was empty. Before I knew it, we were in a steep banking dive to the right. I'd never been in a dive so steep before or since, and while I can't tell you how many degree bank it was, it felt like it was a really high angle. Between the excitement of being in a DC-3 for the first time and the first time taking off with a group of passengers I wasn't landing with, combined with the steep dive and high bank angle, it all felt a bit dreamy to me. The pilot had put down his oxygen mask, and I wondered why, as I was still holding mine over my nose and mouth and was breathing through it. Like I said, it all felt like a dream. The next thing I knew, we were lining up to land, touched down, and came to what felt like a very quick stop on the runway. I commented on it to the pilot, and he said, "That's one of the beauties of the DC-3. What I didn't realize, though, not until I got off the plane, was that just before the skydivers jumped, they turned off the oxygen. That's why we made such a steep dive, to lose altitude quickly. And I mean quickly. That's also why it felt so dreamy to me. I must have been hypoxic. So my first and only flight in a DC-3 is just a memory, and a rather faded one at that. Some of that fade is due to time, but a good deal of it has to do with a lack of oxygen. Some 30-odd years later, I'm still in love with the DC-3. I guess I always will be. Maybe one day, I'll get a chance to fly in one, with enough oxygen in my system to sustain the memory of it. Until then, the dream and the reality of that wonderful flight, that one time back in Pueblo, Colorado, will just have to do. For the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Micah quoted me accurately. To me, the DC-3 is what an airplane should look like. We have a photo of Micah in a DC-3 at the National Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center. It was taken in 2016 by Brian Coleman, with some editing by Captain Nick. We do have another piece by Micah, but that'll be coming up in a bit. Now, student pilot Nikki previously sent us three recordings describing her progress. Now we have the fourth installment, her first solo.
Hello, fellow Airplane Geeks listeners. Nikki here. I wanted to get you guys all caught up on some of my flying. If you guys remember my last episode, I talked about my solo next week. Unfortunately, that did not happen because of a certain hurricane that came through Florida. My house ended up being in the eye of that hurricane, and along with my flight school, so got a little delayed by 3 weeks for cleanup, for the airplanes to come back, and so on and so forth. But it did happen, and I thought I'd tell you a little story about the flight. The flight started like any other flight. Flight instructor went ahead and endorsed my logbook. We went out pre-flight at the aircraft and went ahead and took off and did several trips around the pattern. At which point he told me to taxi back to the ramp, and he jumped out and told me to go ahead and do my first solo around the pattern and to just keep an eye on him after I land. He'll wave me on or call me on the radio if he needs to talk to me. At which point the nerves really kicked in, and I went ahead and taxied down the taxiway to the active runway, made my first takeoff as a solo pilot, and did my first trip around the pattern. Very, very, very nervous. At which point I then taxied back. He didn't do anything, so I just went ahead back to the end of the runway and took off the second time. Did the pattern, but on the way, on final approach, something different happened. Several of the other planes in the area were talking about doing something I've never heard of before, which was switching the airport. Now, I fly in an uncontrolled airport, so I've never actually heard this term until that day, and I didn't think anything about it because everyone knew I was doing my three solo landings, and my instructor was listening on the radio, and he didn't say anything. So I went ahead and landed the plane, and went ahead and started taxiing back to the active runway. There was another plane on the same runway taking off just like me. Well, when it was my turn to take off, I turned on the active runway, hit full power, and started rolling down the runway. Well, about 30 seconds later, I realized, oh, crap. And I will remember this is a family show, because out of the left corner of my eye, I glanced at the windsock, which was pointed the wrong way, which means I didn't have a headwind, I had a tailwind for my takeoff, which meant I had a tailwind for landing as well. So at that point, I had to make a very quick decision. I had enough runway to stop the airplane if I decided to, and then, well, I would be at the right end of the runway now to spin the plane around and take off. But I decided to just go ahead and take off. I could make a few more decisions in the air, and I had a couple of minutes to change my mind and do things once I was in the air. And again, student pilot, very few hours. I was very nervous at this time. So I went ahead and took off. And at our airport at 700 feet is where we turn our crosswind. So I had about a minute to make my next decision once I was in the air. And that decision was pretty easy. If I turn left at 700 feet, I stay in the pattern. If I turn right, I then exit the pattern, and then I can enter the 45 for the other runway, which in this case would have been 2-3. But again, as a student pilot with very, very little hours and very nervous, I decided not to do this because, one, I've never practiced this. I've never done it by myself. It's not something my instructor and I have ever talked about. And with all the nerves I had already, I decided to just go ahead and stay in the pattern. Once I made my crosswind and then downwind, which technically would have been upwind if you think about it, I started thinking in my head, what could possibly go wrong? What should I do? And started going over any procedures I can think of. I was like, told myself, well, the plane should be fast. I'm going to have a tailwind. And I made a couple of decisions, which I believe were smart for that moment, and especially for a student pilot. And I made the decision, when I start descending, I turn my base at 700 feet, and I try to turn final right around 500 feet, which puts me in line with the airport and plenty of time to line up and make sure everything is fine. So I told myself at 500 feet, I'm going to make a decision. If I don't feel comfortable with the landing at 500 feet, I'm just going to do a go-around. And there's a very specific song that came to mind during this approach that definitely kept going over and over my head. And then at 300 feet, between 300 and 200 feet, if I don't feel comfortable with the landing, I was just going to full power, just go around, and then I would, instead of going around, I would just exit the pattern to the right this time and come in for the 45. I believe that was the right decision for me to think of. So when I started descending, I kept running this through my head. 500 feet is my first check. 500 feet. So when I turned base and then final, I lined up on the runway and I asked myself, is this going to be a safe landing? I said, yes, I am perfectly lined up on the runway. As I descended through 4, 3, and then coming close to 200 feet, I said, yes, I am still lined up on the runway. I do have a tailwind. The airplane is handling a little funny, but everything looks fine. My approach looks fine. I did have a little bit of extra airspeed, but I already planned for that. I decided to go ahead once I had the runway made. I pulled the power to idle, and I actually did probably not my best landing out of the three, but I did land the airplane. The plane is still reusable, so I guess it was an excellent landing, but it was a very notable landing for sure. I still think about it today. At which point I then taxied back, parked the airplane, shut it down, and I asked my flight instructor, did I do the right thing? He said he probably would have taxied to the other end of the runway, but I did everything fine. I believe as a student pilot from the situation that I had at hand, being very low time, I believe I made the right decision. Would I make that same decision today? Probably not. Because of that day, every time I walk to the airport, I always check the winds. I always check the METAR report before I even get to the airport, when I get to the airport. When I walk in the FBO, I look at the airfield. I look for that wind sock to see, okay, which way the wind's going. When I walk out to the airplane, I check for the winds. Before that plane moves from its parking place, I check those winds. And definitely before I even taxi onto the active runway, I always check my winds. So with that being said, I wanted to say thank you. My normal closing saying would be always remember to close your flight plan. But I think from now on, I'm going to say always remember to check your weather before taking off.
Thanks, Nikki. In the next installment, Nikki tells us about her second solo. Listen for that in an upcoming episode. Well, longtime listeners remember the Australia Desk report with Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Those two guys sent us really good and sometimes crazy segments for the show. Well, for this special Bits and Pieces episode, they sent in a special Oz Desk.
Bloody hell, crikey. It's a bit musty in here, mate.
Oh, mate, the dust.
Hey, pull that sheet off the panel, would you?
Oh, with the one with the spiders on it? Yeah, hang on.
Spiders? Oh. The dust. Good Lord.
Oh, mate.
How long is it since we've used this studio? Quick, here, I'll just, let me see if I can fire this up. Let's see, connect button.
Oh,
A,
mate, I think it was about B. 41 episodes ago.
All right, Grant, stand back. I'm going to fire up the mixer.
Okay.
It's alive.
It's alive. Hang on. Let me get the Van de Graaff generator going a bit more. The Jacobs ladder. Yep, that's sparking in the background. Excellent. It's like riding a bike. It's true. It all comes back to you, doesn't it?
It all does. That and all of these sound effects, Grant, they're all back.
Oh, that means it's going to be another 3 hours preparation for a 5-minute episode.
You betcha. Welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for, well, you know, Grant, we could say for this year because as we're recording this here in Australia, it's next year.
Woohoo! Welcome to the future where the winning lotto numbers are 3, 5, 7. I hate it when it does that.
Episode 484, I guess.
Oh, no. Yeah, 484. I think that's what they're going to be doing it for. Hard to believe the last one we were on was 442.
Hey, this is one of those bits and pieces ones where, you know, Max says, now, folks, don't tell Max I told you this. Max says to try and keep it short for these bits and pieces episodes.
Yeah, right, like that's ever going to happen.
What have we been doing? The last time we spoke in this segment was back at the Australian International Air Show. That was back in February or March of 2017. So, Grant, you've been putting more miles on Virgin Australia aircraft than most of their pilots, as I like to tell people. What have you been up to?
I've been doing a fair whack of travel. In fact, I just calculated the other day 73 flights, primarily between Australian cities, mostly on the eastern seaboard and Adelaide. But I did do a run over to Auckland, across the ditch, when I took my father over for the five squadron reunion, the Royal New Zealand Air Force one. That was pretty big. Total of 30,200 miles, which isn't bad given it's all domestic. And if all goes well, I've been flying so much that by my annual renewal in mid-February, I'm going to have so many excess credits that I'll be able to gift gold status to Ms. Kit.
Well, you should give them to me, buddy. I mean, you know, we've been together a long time.
Yeah, mate. Yeah, but doing a lot of flying of your own.
I have been doing a lot of flying. Yes, I've walked away from the railways this year, and I've been working in aviation, which is something new for me, and just working for an events company that runs air shows up in Sydney. So that's been really interesting. So I live down here in Melbourne, which is it's about an hour's flight away for those who are not familiar with this part of the world. And I've been doing a fair bit of flying. In fact, there's been a new airline start up here. Well, it's not a new airline, but they've started some regular flights to Melbourne called JetGo, and I've been flying them lately, and flying on their little ERJs, which is quite a new experience for me. It's been quite fun, actually, and very convenient.
Yeah, it's been great. You've been able to fit on them. I mean, they're not a big jet. What's it like? Because I've heard a lot of reports about some people talk about ERJs having tiny seats and all that kind of stuff, but I'm guessing these ones are pretty well decked out.
Well, I got to tell you, there's actually more leg room in the seats on these planes than you'll find on a Qantas or a Virgin Economy class seat, interestingly enough. It's quite comfortable, I'd got to say.
Oh, well done, mate. Well done. I understand they're nice leather wide seats as well.
Well, yeah, the only thing I would say about the JetGo aircraft, if I had, some constructive advice, was they could use a little bit of prettying up inside. They're a little bit weather-beaten inside, I think. Some of the seats could use a bit of sprucing up.
Oh, well, but at least, hey, it's a much easier way to get to work when you're going up there, because you don't have to go to Tullamarine in Melbourne and then fly to Kingsford Smith in Sydney, rent a car and drive down to Wollongong. You actually get to go and drive to Essendon, one of our favourite airports in Melbourne, with all the biz jets, jump on board JetGo and get off and walk to your office across the tarmac.
That's exactly right. In fact, yes, my office is at the Illawarra Regional Airport in Wollongong. It's wonderful. You get off at the little terminal there, and yeah, it's about a 2-minute walk to the office.
The agony.
It's very nice. I guess news-wise at the moment, Grant, just trying to think of some stories here. I've just started up a new podcast I'll talk about in a minute for Australian Aviation Magazine, which is a lot of fun. But we've been talking this week about some news that's sprung up about the issue of foreign pilot visas, and the government here is looking to fast-track plans to fill what they've suddenly discovered is a gap in the market. There's the shortage of airline pilots, apparently.
Yeah, they're basically running around saying, because they modified the 457 visa, worker visa system, to start saying no pilots, which has led to a couple of, I know from the commercial hot air ballooning world, they're actually starting a couple of pilot factories up north, which is a good thing. But on the commercial airline side of things, there's been such a bit of a hoo-ha about lack of pilots that they're actually opening up the 457s even more for commercial regional kind of ATPL pilots.
You know, the sad thing is, I think this situation has been coming for a long time, and we've talked a lot in this segment over the years about how Australia's training sector is it's really stifled in a lot of ways, I think, through over-regulation by a very overzealous regulator here, and the expense of it all with very high user fees and airport privatisation, ATC privatisation, or corporatisation at least, and all that sort of stuff. It doesn't make it really attractive for local pilots. So, a lot of flying training schools here now around this country are surviving primarily by opening their doors to Chinese airlines and the like, sending their students here, and, they're making a good living out of that. But your average guy off the street walking into a flight school and taking flight training I wouldn't say it's non-existent here, but it just doesn't happen that much. And so, there's not a lot of pathways through. And I think the other side to think about too, industrially, is, we really have to look here at whether or not the airlines will use this as an excuse to bring in some cheap foreign labour, which is not a good thing either. And, if they think they can save a few bucks, they're probably going to be tempted to do that. And I don't think that our airline pilot friends in this part of the world are going to be too happy at that prospect.
It's a very interesting market change by allowing all this to happen and what it does. I mean, standards, they've got to be held to the same standards. Then there's is also which unions do they join. We're already seeing the situation where you've got Kiwi pilots flying Red Tail aircraft, not just Jet Connect, but now they're also Qantas are also looking at having some of the cheaper Kiwi pilots flying their aircraft inside Australia, coming in on Jet Connect, then flying a full mainline, I believe. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of stuff going on, and I think we're going to have a very interesting time in 2018 watching this one unfold.
I certainly will. I guess that gives me a nice segue to talk about the new Australian Aviation Radio podcast. So folks, you'd know that over the years, of course, we've quite often quoted articles from Australian Aviation Magazine, and you know, it's recently been taken over by a new management group, and part of that is a bit of a change in the way that they present it. So there'll still be the print edition, but they're certainly going digital. And part of that is I was very privileged to be asked to produce some podcasts for them. So we've done two episodes of that now as we record this, and it's really great. I'm really thrilled to be working with that publication, Grant. I think it's something that you and I have really harboured, you know, the ambitions to do that for a long time. And well, at least one of us got there. You just got a job. You just got a job in defence.
Yeah, I did. I start making the news rather than reporting on it. I know a lot of the guys in the new and the old world of the Australian Aviation Magazine, and we have worked together with them a number of times in other projects, and I think it's great that you're getting the opportunity to take all that experience you've got about putting out a high-quality, great-sounding podcast and now doing it for your favourite aviation magazine as well.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Hey, Grant, I guess we should answer some people's questions that are inevitably going to pop up there. What are we doing with PCDU? Do we know?
Well, I thought we might just park it out the back like my RX-7 that's just waiting for some work to be done on it.
Unfortunately, career-wise, Grant and I have had, you know, we've had big career changes, and it's just really takes up a lot of our time now. And, you know, to produce Plane Crazy the way we did it, it took a huge amount of effort, and it's been a great adventure. And I think we'll, you know, we'll drip feed some bits and pieces out there over the next year. We've got a lot of back catalogue of content that's a little old but still interesting that we could run up. But, yeah, I don't think we're going to be producing too many of those anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah, maybe we just spit it out and park it in SoundCloud or things like that and just let people know when it's there on Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be sad to see PCDU die off, but it's been a great adventure, and, you know, it's led to a lot of other things for us, and, you know, we have to pursue those. So I hope people understand that. And, you know, as always, we want to thank everyone at the Airplane Geeks for really making that possible. You know, Grant, I think between us, we've met every member of the Airplane Geeks podcast except for Max.
Yeah, I know. We're going to have to fix that at some point.
So he remains the man of international podcast mystery. You know, I've even met Dan Webb.
Yeah, even the V Australia flight attendants have met Dan Webb, as in the famous "I'll behave" moment.
Yes, and who could forget rainbows and unicorns? Well, anyway, Grant, I think that's everything we have for you on this year's Australia Desk. I think I said that on the last one, didn't I?
Yeah, pretty much. But just don't forget, mate, as Geoffrey Chaucer once said, all good things must come to an end. And, you know, we'll still be around, we'll still be going on, and who knows, we may pop up on a future Australia Desk.
That sounds good. Well, until next time, whenever that is, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm still Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks. And Grant, how do we shut this thing down?
I don't know. Do we have to... hang on.
Don't touch that button. Don't touch that button.
I don't know about you, but for me, it felt really good to hear Steve and Grant's voices again. You know, we have episode 500 coming up later this year, and we'll see if we can make Steve and Grant part of whatever it is we'll decide to do to celebrate that milestone. So thanks, guys. Also, be sure to give the Australian Aviation Podcast a listen. Again, it's at australianaviation.com.au. Well, speaking of new aviation podcasts, Pete Combs has a new one, and we asked him to introduce it to you. Here's Pete.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, producer and host of AIN's Human Factor, Tales from the Flight Deck. And it might just be the neatest little podcast you've never heard yet. Tales from the Flight Deck is built as an instructional program, but you know, it's an instructional program in the same way as great hangar flying is instructional. Those stories almost always begin with, I knew this guy who flew this plane and did this thing, and you won't believe what happened. Well, on AIN's Human Factor, we do you one better than that. We bring you stories directly from the pilots who actually live through some pretty harrowing moments aloft, along with expert analysis from instructors and pilots who've both been there and done that. Each of our episodes is about as long as it takes you to get to or from work. You can find AIN's Human Factor, Tales from the Flight Deck, on Apple's iTunes, Stitcher, Google Music, and TuneIn Radio. Hey, one more thing. If you have a story to tell, or if you know someone who does, or if you'd like to ask a question or leave a comment, please get in touch with me. My email address is info@humanfactorproductions.com. I'm Pete Combs. We'll see you on the flight deck.
A little later this episode, Pete will come back and tell you a bit about the latest episode. Next up, as you no doubt know, besides producing Airplane Geeks and the UAV Digest, I co-host with Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast. It's a 30-minute monthly show where we talk with a guest about current topics concerning the passenger experience. Isaac Alexander, Jet City Star, was our guest on episode 53, where we talked about the Mitsubishi MRJ, aerospace accelerator startups, and PaxX conferences and exhibitions to be held around the world in 2018. In that last segment, Mary talked about the passenger experience topics likely to be important in 2018. I asked Mary if we could play a clip, and she graciously said sure. So here's Mary from episode 53 of the PaxX podcast.
So it's interesting. The PaxX trends are becoming much easier to predict and discuss because there's some very, very clear ones out there. It comes as absolutely zero surprise to our listeners, Max, that, of course, the trend towards the high-density seating continues apace on board aircraft, and much to the chagrin of many passengers, with, of course, as you know, the 787 being pretty much standard now at 9 abreast. It's a very tight configuration. The 777 now increasingly standard at 10 abreast. A lot of these Boeing types coming under a lot of scrutiny simply because of the cross-sectional, what they're able to handle in terms of seats and seat width. And of course, seat pitch being tightened up and airlines realizing that they can monetize those extra inches, whether they're offering extra legroom products or a premium economy product. They're effectively getting people to pay for the additional what used to be standard part of the product are now the kind of bells and whistles. And in order to have a comfortable experience, you actually have to be willing to pay for those extra increasingly. And we're seeing that, of course, across the board, whether it's the low-cost carriers or the legacy carriers. They're really the high densification of aircraft is happening. It's and it doesn't look like that's going to change any day soon. Alas! So if you want a comfortable ride, particularly long haul, you do need to pay a bit extra for the premium economy or the extra legroom economy seat. Another thing that we actually are seeing that remains consistent on long haul is the fact that those seat back screens, those in-seat IFE systems, they are still in play, and most wide-body aircraft are ordered with those. And I firmly believe that if you're tracking aircraft interiors, you need to be tracking what's happening from an in-flight connectivity standpoint and an in-flight entertainment standpoint, because they're pacing parallel to each other. So as you've gone this very high-density long-haul 777s and 787s, the idea of not offering something to try and distract passengers, it just doesn't make sense. So those IFE systems, it's not like they're some sort of nice give from the airline. They're aimed at distracting you from the discomfort that you're in the back of the aircraft. So that's all still the case, Max. You know, we're just seeing more and more of the high density if you're an economy class passenger. Obviously, in business, it's also going high density, but you get the increasingly you get the aisle access and the full flat experience. But, you know, as we've talked about on Airplane Geeks, you know, it's also a bit more of a coffin experience. You know, yeah. You're enclosed, but hey, that's what the business traveler seems to be calling for. So that's And of course, on the connectivity front, the expectation is an at-home experience in the sky that is increasingly being demanded. And the airlines that aren't able to offer that or aren't getting clever with how they package their connectivity are coming under serious scrutiny by passengers on social media that are very vocal about now their passenger experience, including the connectivity. So the pressure is really on the connectivity providers to step up their game in a major way. And with all of that said, you know, you have a number of really big events on the passenger experience calendar. And I have to say, it's getting kind of crowded out there. So some of the must-attend events for us. So I will be at International CES in January, kind of paying attention to some of the passenger experience trends that we may be seeing. From a consumer technology standpoint, Panasonic has a huge presence at International CES, and they're going to actually be highlighting a lot of their PAXX technologies there. So it's interesting that the year now gets started quite early. International CES is right there in January. And then in March, you have Satellite 2018, which has become a must-attend for us, because what is occurring from the satellite standpoint ultimately trickles down into what's happening in passenger experience, because these satellites are, of course, supporting the high-speed connectivity that all the passengers are demanding. April brings us to the huge Aircraft Interiors Expo in Hamburg. That has become our main event for the year, simply because you have players across the travel experience, including all of the major aircraft seat makers. And they're there and they, you know, open their doors and let you on the stand and see the latest and greatest kind of that's happening in aircraft interiors. So that's become a must attend. Another event that is on our calendar now is the Aviation Festival Americas. That's really kind of become something that we're seeing more and more, say, for example, of sponsors of Runway Girl attending, because they get a lot of airlines there at that event. Another one is the Global Connected Aircraft Summit. That's out in San Diego. That has kind of become the premier in-flight connectivity specific event on the calendar. And then, of course, you get into the, you know, alternating years, the Paris Air Show. And then, of course, this year it's going to be Farnborough Air Show. We like to have a presence there. And then the big Apex Expo in September, in the fall. So it's a busy old calendar right now, but I feel like we need to have a presence at, you know, if not all, most of these events, because there is so much happening and things are evolving quickly. And, you know, on top of everything else, airlines are really trying to give a much more personalized passenger experience. So they are using technology in a much more clever way. And that includes connectivity, including arming the cabin crew, for example, with tablets that are connected and able to tell that flight attendant a little bit about the passenger in order to have a much more personalized experience for that passenger on board. So maybe you're sitting in a seat that's incredibly grossly uncomfortable, Max, but you know, the flight attendant increasingly might know your name and your favorite drink and may say, well, okay, I know his legs are hurting, so that means he needs a second glass of his red wine. You know, I mean, we may be moving in that direction where it's more about the personal passenger experience and the interaction with crew that are really on their game and tech equipped. That seems to be where we are headed. Now,
Mary is pretty impressive when it comes to knowledge and insight about the passenger experience. You can find the PAXX podcast, along with a lot of other in-depth content about the passenger experience, over at runwaygirlnetwork.com. Or visit PAXXpodcast.com to go straight to the podcast. That's PAXXpodcast.com. And you can learn more about the conferences Mary mentioned at runwaygirlnetwork.com/events. Tim Trott, the drone professor, saw that Detect Inc. had installed a new bird and drone warning system at the Northwest Beaches International Airport, KECP. Detect specializes in advanced radar and other sensor technologies. They offer bird radar technologies for real-time aircraft bird strike avoidance, as well as wind energy bird mortality risk assessment and mitigation, and industrial bird control. They have over 180 Merlin bird radars operating in the United States, Canada, Europe, Africa, and Asia. These days, bird detection makes you think about drone detection. So Tim contacted the Panama City, Florida company and recorded a telephone interview with Craig Rainey. Here it is.
I'm Tim Trott, the drone professor. Recently, I learned that a local Panama City company had installed a new bird and drone warning system at Northwest Beaches International Airport, KECP. So I contacted Craig Rainey at DTEC by phone
and asked him, what is the new system you put in at KECP?
So the system is a three-tier system. Basically, we use the app that's available on Android phones, which gives field staff the ability to look at the data in real time. We've integrated an RF sensor that's on top of the air traffic control tower that will pick up drone signal. And then the second phase of the installation of the project was to add the bird radar, which is also used for drone surveillance and drone watching. So that completes the second phase of the project, and now we have a fully operational system that monitors bird activity as well as drones in the area.
And birds, I think, being near the beaches and everything, that'd probably be your primary concern, and the drone thing. I don't think there's been a whole lot of drone activity in that airport, or am I wrong?
No, they have not had any drone activity. We've had detection outside the perimeter toward the beach area, which is more than 5 miles away from the airport. So we have detection range, 5 to 10 miles, depending on the height of the sensors. Bird activity is something we monitor. It is based upon historical data as well as real-time data that we collect. The bird activity at the airport is just monitored by the air traffic control tower. It does fluctuate depending on the migration season. So both in the spring and in the fall, we have high migratory paths depending on, where they're going north or south. So looking at the historical data, knowing when the rates increase is when we are more prepared to monitor the data that's coming from the radar.
So in practicality, what happens if they have a detection? What do they do if they got, United coming in, or Southwest is coming in, or Delta's coming in? They do a go-around or what?
So they monitor, basically the system has three different levels of risk. It's a low, medium, or high. And should the air traffic control tower see that the risk is high, then they would want to assess the risk and see if it's a large flock of birds or if it's just a couple of birds. At that point, if they think it's something the pilot needs to be aware of, then they would notify the pilot to delay their approach.
So basically, it could be a go-around, for example. When you talk about the RF, we're looking at 2.4 and 5.8, or what else?
Correct, yes. 2.4, 5.8, and Lightbridge. So we're doing three different spectrums.
Oh, Lightbridge as well. Okay. So you were talking about the Drone Watcher app. Can you describe that a little bit? That's something that is private use by the airport staff or ATC?
The Drone Watcher app, it's a free app that can be downloaded on any Android phone, and it monitors the 2.4 gigahertz range. It provides real-time notifications. Also, with the pro version of the app, you can integrate mapping. So you can actually pull up a map of the area and see where the drone is located. The app also gives you a feature to add in groups. So if you have a group that's wanting to be notified if one user is seeing a drone or alerted to a drone, then that will push that alert out to the group users.
Sounds like something would be very useful for law enforcement.
It would be. Yes, it would be. We're actually working with different law enforcement. We've done some demonstrations with them. This would be a very good tool to have at any type of a sporting event or concert, that you'd have a security group that's in charge of security that could have the alerts real time in their hand on their phone.
I can think of like the fires that they had in California that would be very useful for the air boss.
Correct. It is. Yeah, they would be able to, if one user was detecting a drone, then it would send the alert out to the entire group. Then anyone that might need to know that information would have it instantly.
Wow. Okay, are there applications that might extend into beyond visual line of sight? Kind of, in a way, sort of.
Firefighters.
Yeah, yeah.
When the firefighters are fighting a large area. So if you've got a group that's situated in a 10-mile radius of a fire, then anyone in that group would benefit from having the knowledge of a drone in the area.
Well, is there a cost or membership or some kind of approval or something that's needed for using the app?
Nope. We have two versions. We have the free app, which can be downloaded off of Google Play and also Amazon's website. And then the app can be upgraded to the pro version. It's $5 for the pro version.
Wow.
That does give you the ability to do the mapping as well as do the group messaging.
Any plans for iOS?
Not yet. They have their system locked down. They do not want to grant privileges to certain parts of their phone. So we've tried, but currently there's no plans for that.
Oh, well. Okay, your website shows a long list of rather big customer names from the Air Force, Army, Navy, FAA, NASA.
Yes. So we've done, for many years, we've worked with the Air Force and NASA. We actually did 29 manned missions with NASA, monitoring bird activity prior to the space shuttle launches. The Air Force, we've worked with them for many years. Air Force is a very heavy user of the radar to detect birds in the area. You know, one bird strike can cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in damage to an aircraft or, you know, take it down.
My thanks to Craig Rainey at DTEC for taking time to talk with me. If you want to know more about it, check their website at DTEC-INC.com. I'm Tim Trott, the Drone Professor for the UAV Digest.
Thanks, Tim. This was recorded with the UAV Digest podcast in mind, but it's applicable here as well, so we added it to the Bits and Pieces episode. You can learn more at detect-inc.com. That's DETECT-INC.com. And we'll have a link in the show notes to a news article on this from Unmanned Systems Technology. And finally, the Drone Professor provides online and on-site training for drone pilot certification, drone operations, as well as topics related to unmanned aircraft in public service, law enforcement, emergency services, public safety, and related areas. You can find all that at thedroneprofessor.com. I just wanted to give a quick shout-out to Tom Rogers. Tom is an engineering associate director at Pratt & Whitney. He has over 25 years in fan and compressor aero, and he's an avid fan of airplane geeks. He also listens to Airline Pilot Guy. Tom recently moved from the old, and I mean old, Pratt Engineering Building to the new Engineering and Technology Center. It's a magnificent-looking structure from the outside. I hope to be able to see it from the inside sometime soon. Well, Tom wrote us and said, "It's sad to see the PW4000-powered Boeing 747-400 fleets being retired by Delta and United." He says, "I've had the pleasure of flying business trips on Delta's NWA birds round trip to Narita from JFK and DTW, that's Detroit Metropolitan Airport, all upper deck, old seats 2x2, and the new herringbone lie-flat." He says, "On my last flight home back in February, I was invited up for a photo opportunity in the left seat. Priceless. I've attached the picture for your enjoyment." Well, we'll have that photo in the show notes. Tom also mentioned that Delta is treating their customers well. He says he's a loyal Medallion member, and they fly him almost everywhere the Eagle sends him. The Eagle is what us Pratt folks, particularly the older Pratt folks, call the company. Well, Tom, thanks for being a member of our community. We'll have that cockpit photo in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/484. Our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, had the opportunity to speak with Michael Dorn. He's the actor who played the Klingon Worf in the Star Trek franchise. Well, Dorn is a pilot, and he's owned a number of warbirds. Launchpad met him at a Star Trek convention. Of course he did. Where else are you going to meet a Klingon?
Hey, Airplane Geeks listener. This is Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. 2 weeks ago, I attended the Star Trek convention in Dallas, Texas. And before you write me off as a total geek, one, you're correct. But the reason I was there, I had a chance to run into Mr. Michael Dorn. We unfortunately did not have a chance to sit down and do an interview, but I wanted to pass on these thoughts with my encounter with him. He was very gracious, and we talked about flying for about 10 to 15 minutes. You may recognize Mr. Michael Dorn. He played Worf in all 7 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation, 4 seasons of Deep Space Nine, plus 4 of the movies. But I didn't talk to him about that. I had a chance to talk to him about flying. He's a serious pilot. He began flying during the 2nd season of Star Trek The Next Generation in 88 and just kept going. At one point, he owned an F-86 Sabre and a couple of other warbirds and was very happy with them. He now flies a Cessna CJ-1. One of his interesting observations was that maintaining the CJ-1 is the same price as maintaining a warbird. In fact, he misses warbirds. He's in love with going fast and the smell of JP-8. So now he's in the market for another warbird, and he has his eyes on an F-104 or an F-5. I wish him all the luck. We discussed the fact that he's against privatizing ATC. He enjoys flying. He flies the Cessna CJ-1 single seat. Other things we talked about, I asked him about the studio interfering with his flying. The only time the studio interfered with him flying was they would not allow him to fly during the filming of the 4 movies, which were huge 75-day blocks where he was not allowed to go flying. But during the television show, he was allowed to fly all he wanted. Aviators are everywhere. Just start looking for them. This is Launchpad Marzari, Airplane Geeks reporter at large. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Thanks, Launchpad. You've probably heard the great reports Launchpad has sent us over the years. If you have a chance to talk with someone in aviation or attend an aviation event, consider making a recording and send it to us. It's not difficult, and you can use your smartphone. Contact us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Next up, astronaut Bruce McCandless passed away on December 21st, 2017. He was the first man to fly in space without a tether. Our main man, Micah, looks back on the man and his accomplishments.
When you think about the first spacewalk, maybe you think about cosmonaut Alexei Leonov, who in March 1965 was the first man to ever leave the relative safety of a space capsule. Maybe it's Ed White you think of, who in June 1965 opened the hatch of Gemini 4 and was the first American to walk in space. The name Gene Cernan may come to mind. He flew Gemini 9A in June of 1966 and spent over 2 hours on an EVA. That EVA almost killed him due to our lack of understanding of the physical exertion it took to work in space and the cooling system in his spacesuit not being able to keep up with it. Then there's Buzz Aldrin. Sure, the second man on the moon, but actually the first man to successfully conduct a mission while on a spacewalk. In November 1966, on Gemini 12, the final Gemini mission, Buzz Aldrin conducted 3 EVAs that totaled more than 5 hours in space. Buzz Aldrin was a man that really taught us how to work in space. EVAs seem rather commonplace today, even though they're always incredibly dangerous, always a challenge, and always very closely monitored from both onboard the spacecraft and from the ground. The general public doesn't think of EVAs as anything special. In some ways, that's sad. It's also sad that we don't think of the man that paved the way for the modern spacewalk, probably don't know his name, and certainly don't have any idea that he passed away on December 21st of 2017. In February 1984, at the age of 39, Bruce McCandless was the first person to ever truly walk in space. And by truly, I mean untethered. You see, those 4 spacewalks I mentioned before, while all incredible feats of both courage and science, all had one thing in common. Those men were tethered to their spacecraft, connected by an umbilical cord. Although in an emergency, none of them could be safely pulled back into their spacecraft by the tether, They couldn't just go floating off into space. On the other hand, in February 1984, Bruce McCandless flew in space, no strings attached. He piloted himself in what we call the MMU, the Manned Maneuvering Unit. As the youngest member of Astronaut Group 5 at the age of 28, Bruce McCandless joined NASA in 1966. Although a pilot, he was not a trained test pilot and was effectively treated as a, quote, scientist astronaut, unquote. You see, Chief Astronaut Deke Slayton, along with the other NASA managers of the time, only wanted experienced test pilots as crew. Because of that, Bruce McCandless was not put into flight rotation for some time. He served as CAPCOM for Apollo 11 and the first ever lunar EVA by Neil Armstrong. He was also CAPCOM for Apollo 14 and Skylab 3 and 4. Although his first flight assignment was as backup crew for the first Skylab mission, his first spaceflight didn't come until STS-41B in 1984, when he flew Space Shuttle Challenger. But what a flight that was. You see, it was Bruce McCandless's scientific work as co-investigator on the M509 Astronaut Maneuvering Unit experiment on Skylab that led to his assignment to STS-41B. It was that Challenger mission that brought him into space to test a manned maneuvering unit, the MMU that allowed him to become the first person to ever leave a spacecraft untethered. Bruce McCandless became what we always imagined in science fiction. He was his own little spacecraft hovering around the ship, flying under his own power in the MMU he developed as he flew untethered as far as 320 feet, that's 98 meters, away from Challenger. So as I've said, you may not know the name Bruce McCandless, but my guess is that you've seen him. That iconic NASA photo of an astronaut flying free above the Earth? That's Bruce McCandless. He may not have come to NASA as a test pilot, but he sure talked like one. He said that when he made that iconic spacewalk, his wife was at mission control, and there was quite a bit of apprehension. Wanting to break the tension, he first thought of what Neil Armstrong said when he first stepped foot on the moon. That's when Bruce McCandless said, and I quote, "It may have been a small step for Neil, but it's a heck of a big leap for me." When asked what it was like to fly untethered in space, he said, quote, "I've been told of the quiet vacuum you experience in space, but with three radio links saying, 'How's your oxygen holding out? Stay away from the engines,' and 'When's my turn?' It wasn't that peaceful," unquote. Bruce McCandless left us at age 80 on December 21st, 2017. Another NASA hero, probably unknown to most of us, is gone from this world. So may God bless Bruce McCandless, who is now eternally untethered. Let's hope this, his final untethered flight, is a bit more peaceful than his first. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
You've heard us mention our Slack listener team, and I just wanted to take a few minutes to describe it in more detail. Slack is an online platform where members can post messages and photos or other files. It was originally created as a place where work groups could collaborate, but it has grown in popularity to the point where Slack teams have been created for all kinds of purposes. Conversations are threaded and organized into subject areas called channels. You can access Slack through iOS, Android, a Windows app, or even through a browser. We set up a Slack team 2 years ago as a bit of an experiment to see if this format resonated with you. And it did. We now have over 200 members. The channels in our Slack team organize different topics. There's an Airplane Geeks channel, and that's just for general comments and conversation about aviation. There's an announcements channel. We have a couple of event channels. There's an events and meetups channel, and that's where we talk about upcoming events, where team members organize meetups. But we also have a channel specific to EAA Air Venture Oshkosh for 2018, where folks can do some planning for that event. We have an episode feedback channel and introduce yourself channel, where members have an opportunity to tell everybody a little bit about themselves. We also have a PaxX channel and a channel for the UAV Digest. So those two podcasts also have their little subject areas. And then finally, there's a random channel, and that can be just about anything, but it's proved to be a great way to learn more about other listeners and what they're up to. You can also direct message other members, and there's several other features in Slack, but I won't go into those here. Across the channels, you'll find topical conversations, sometimes some extra material that's not in the podcast episodes, also previews of what's coming up. Slack gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of what level of notifications you want to receive, so you can set your preferences to get notified whenever something new happens there, or just when somebody mentions you or a particular thread that you're following. It's very handy in that regard. Now, in order to keep the conversations focused, valuable, and spam-free, membership to the Airplane Geeks Slack team is by invitation. That's why you don't see us posting calls to join on Twitter or elsewhere. It's a community for the listeners, for you, about aviation. If you'd like to join, write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Tell us the email address you want to use as your Slack ID. And, of course, we don't collect those email addresses or use them for anything else. So have a look and join in the fun. Now here's Pete Combs again to tell you a little about the current episode of AIN's The Human Factor, Tales from the Flight Deck.
Howdy, geeks. Our latest tale from the flight deck is part two on the HIMSS program. HIMSS stands for Human Intervention Motivation Study, and it was started way back in 1974 as a way to deal with addiction on the flight deck. You know, not so long ago, flying drunk was the stuff of jokes from the likes of Foster Brooks and Dean Martin.
Is it our home? All right. If I join you, I just dropped in for a little drink to settle my nerves before I go to work.
Work. What sort of work do you do?
I'm an airline pilot.
But in 1990, people stopped laughing with the arrest of Lyle Prouse and two crew members on board Northwest Airlines Flight 650. Prouse spent 15 months in federal prison. Since then, it happens about once a month. A pilot is identified as an alcoholic and stripped of his or her medical. It happened to Corey Sloan after a night of blackout drinking in Newark, New Jersey.
Oh my God, I'm late. Get to the airport, get through security, thank goodness. Get onto the airplane, stow my bag, sit in the seat, start going, okay, what do I need to do to get this thing going? And within about a minute, an ops person and the captain show up and say, hey man, you need to get your stuff, get off the airplane.
But for guys like Sloan and for thousands of other pilots, there is a path to redemption, and that is the HIMSS program. You can hear this and all of our podcasts at AINonline.com/humanfactor. You'll also find us on Apple's iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. Thanks, guys. We'll see you on the flight deck.
Now, listener Glenn tells us about his airplane of the week, the de Havilland Mosquito.
I'm here with another airplane of the week. It's Electric Lightning, years ago now, I guess. This is one of my favourite aircraft. On about the Mosquito for hours. But instead I will talk and the Highball Bomb Carrier. In 1943, a standard Mosquito, it was originally designed as a tank buster. Instead was given over to the RAF Coastal Command. It was now filled with the Mullins modified 6-pounder anti-tank gun, 25 rounds, which contained no explosives in the warhead, but used kinetic energy to damage the target. The big gun was offset from the centre line of the Mosquito by the 4x303 Browning machine guns. Of the cannon bay was left in place. It was also carrying 300 pounds of extra armour plate, which is the cabin door, engines, as well as strengthened flaps and auto feed system for the gun was designed by the Mullins company. Cigarette vending machines. Resultant variant of the Mosquito was RK-18 and made its first 8th of June 1943 and returned to the Tetsi. The prototype aircraft was given the RAF seal HJ-G. The G meaning that the aircraft was so secret it had to be kept under armed guards at all times. The Tetsi was always a rare aircraft, with a grand total of only 27 ever built. This was basically due to just a big gun faction in the RAF and the ref rocket projectile. Ultimately, the rocket projectile fans won the argument, and the FB-18. And a footnote, the strange thing is the gun had actually some sense in training, actually only 5%. Operated in small numbers by 248 Squadron, 254 Squadron, Special Detachment of 618 Squadron, by the Port Reef. Mark 18s were sent out in twos and threes as part of mixed hunting surface vessels, voyaging fjords and across the wild, wide waters of the Bay of Biscay. Diving from a height of 5,000 feet at a 30-degree angle, the Tetsi could unleash bursts of 3 or 4 shells at around 1 second. 57mm shell, moving at moving velocity, 1,950 feet per second, could do fearsome damage to any vessel. Gunned U-boats were finding it out on to a little chance against the Texi, and it did sink many vessels. For example, on the 25th, Officer D. Turner and Flying Officer D. Curtis, along with another Texi, sunk U-976 near Saint-Nazaire, Air France. And also in June 1944, a U-821 was attacked so hard that the crew abandoned her. 8 U-boats were sunk by Texi Mosquitoes. On the 8th of March of the same year, U-88s tried to interfere with Mosquito anti-shipping operations, and 3 of the U-88s were shot down, including one which was actually shot down using the Mullins gun, which very nearly removed an engine from the U-88, and the rest of the aircraft, which was little left of it anyway, crashed into the sea. After the war, all the Tetsi Mosquitoes were scrapped. Now to the Highball Mosquito. 618 Squadron, which you mentioned before, had an even less well-known role in the U-Board 2, was testing of the Barnes-Wallace weapon called Highball, which was designed to be used against warship Tirpitz and then against Japanese warships in the Pacific. The Highball was like a giant golf ball and was being tested before the world-famous upkeep weapon, the bouncing bomb, which was used by the dam busters on the German dams. But another weapon designed by Barnes-Wallace, the Tallboy bomb, was used by 617 Squadron and Flying Lancasters, sank the Tirpitz when it was moved too far north for the Mosquito to reach. The legendary test pilot Winkle Brown landed a Mosquito on an aircraft carrier as part of trials for the deployment to the Far East of these aircraft. This was a pretty amazing feat of flying, this being the heaviest aircraft to land on an aircraft carrier during World War II, proving that the Mosquito could take off and land from carriers. The actual plan was to send 2 aircraft carriers to the Far East, and 618 Squadron was deployed to Australia in February 1945, but the war had ended before the weapon was ever used in anger. But some were tested on a disused railway tunnel somewhere in Wales by dropping through the tunnel entrance flying his aircraft. It was also tested on all naval ships in a lock in Scotland. So more proof that this Mosquito was the first real multi-role aircraft in the world. Another fact I found interesting is that the Mosquito dropped something like 35,000 tons of bombs for the loss of only 193 aircraft. The Mosquito could carry over a long distance the same bomb load as a B-17, but only had 2 crew, making it a much more efficient bomber than the B-17. That's the end of that. I hope you enjoyed my airplane of the week.
Thank you, Glenn. Another listener, Jim Hearn, recorded a short story about an incident that he was involved in while living in Rwanda in the late 1980s. He calls it my most interesting flying experience.
My Most Interesting Flying Experience by Jim Hearn. Since I was a small boy, I've always had a fascination with airplanes and flying. When I was younger, I was a prolific model airplane builder, and I had an extensive collection of picture books covering all types of military airplanes. For as long as I can remember, I wanted to get my pilot's license, but it always seemed like the circumstances were not right or I did not have the money. That all changed in 1985 when I moved to Rwanda to manage a small business development project. After a couple of years in Kigali, I learned there was a flying club in town that offered flying lessons. In early 1988, I joined the club, took the student pilot test, and began taking lessons. Since Rwanda was a former Belgian colony, and French was the official language, most everything aviation related was done in French. the written test, all conversations with my instructor, and radio communications with the tower were all in French. My instructor, Guy Shorokov, was a teacher at the Belgian school, and in his spare time, he provided lessons on a volunteer basis for club members. So getting my license in Rwanda turned out to be a bargain, as all I had to pay for was time on the airplane. We used the club's Cessna 150 for the lessons, which is a small, cramped, two-seat trainer. Needless to say, Guy and I became very good friends over the 9 months it took me to earn my license. I was also a very active member of the club, and I was the treasurer for 2 years. In late 1989, the board decided to organize an aviation event at the Gibiro Lodge in Akagera Park, the main game park located in eastern Rwanda. There was a grass strip next to the lodge, which is about 55 kilometers northeast of Kigali. The club's vice president, Jean-Claude, another member and I decided to fly out to the lodge to check out the runway and make arrangements for our event. We planned to bring 2 airplanes to Gibiro for the event and to offer flights over the park for the public. We would be using the club's Cessna 150 and a privately owned MS-892 Rally Commodore, which is a French-built 4-seat low-wing airplane. For our visit, the 3 of us flew out in the rally, and we had an uneventful flight out with Jean-Claude as pilot in command. At that time, I had a total of about 60 hours of flight time, so I still considered myself a relatively inexperienced pilot. I had very little time on the rally and no experience with Gibiro, as it was somewhat remote and it had a significant slope to it. The runway was lined east-west. It was 2,300 feet long, and I'd estimate it had about a 5% grade. As with all airports in Rwanda, elevation was a factor, since all of them are at least 5,000 feet above sea level. The Gibiro landing chart instructed pilots to land on the uphill slope, runway 10, and to take off on the downhill slope, runway 28, no matter what the prevailing wind direction was. Since the runway was not fenced, pilots were also instructed to make a low pass over the runway before landing to check for wild animals. Once we finished our business with the lodge, we headed back to the rally for the return flight to Kigali. Jean-Claude suggested that I pilot the plane for the return flight and that I do a couple of touch-and-goes before leaving to familiarize myself with Gibiro. I climbed into the left-hand seat, Jean-Claude took the right seat, and after completing the checklist, we headed out to runway 28 for takeoff. The takeoff was an easy one as we were heading downhill and there was a headwind to help us get into the air. Once in the air, I completed my go-round and lined myself up for the landing on runway 10. I had myself lined up correctly with the runway, but because of the uphill slope, I misjudged my altitude and came in quite low. We touched down a bit hard in the weeds at the end of the runway, and immediately Jean-Claude took control of the airplane. He said he was concerned that the landing gear may have been damaged by the touchdown, and he did not want to have the plane stuck out in Gibiro waiting for repairs if that was the case. Jean-Claude immediately pushed the throttle to the firewall and put the plane back in the air. The plane struggled to gain altitude as we were flying up the slope of the runway and we had a slight tailwind at our backs. The altitude of the airport and the fact that the plane was fairly heavily loaded, 3 passengers plus flight cases, also worked against us. The plane was in the air, but we were flying up the runway at an altitude of about 1 meter above the ground. When we got to the upper end of the runway, the ground leveled off and the plane followed the terrain and maintained the same altitude. Within seconds, we clipped a small tree with our left wing, and that slowed us enough that we lost all lift. The plane pancaked onto the ground, the engine stopped, and the landing gear collapsed. We skidded through the grass for a couple of seconds until the right wing hit a termite mound that nearly ripped the wing off the plane. We spun around 180 degrees, and the plane came to a stop facing back towards the eastern end of the runway. Fortunately for us, the fuel tanks remained intact, no fuel leaked from the engine, and no fire broke out. We immediately pushed the canopy back to evacuate the plane, but Jean-Claude could not get his seatbelt undone. When the right wing was pushed back, it cinched up his seatbelt so tight he could not get his buckle open. We found a pocket knife and cut his belt so he could get out. Despite the delay, we were all out of the plane within a minute or so of stopping, and then we stood back from the plane trying to figure out what had happened. We were very lucky that nobody was hurt, there was no fire, and there was no disruption to local air traffic because Gabiro is a very infrequently used airport. The rally was a total loss, but the owner had it insured, and he received a payout from the insurance company for the value of the airplane. The club did not hold the planned event because it made no sense to have only the Cessna 150 available for flights. I remained in Rwanda for another year and continued flying using the Cessna. When I moved back to the USA in 1990, my flying career went on hold. Since Rwanda, I have not lived anywhere else where it has been as convenient or as enjoyable to go flying as it was in Kigali.
Thanks for that, Jim. We're so happy there weren't any injuries. We have some photos in the show notes that show you the extent of the damage to the airplane. Have a look there. At the Rose Parade, January 1st in Pasadena, Brian witnessed the flyover of two F-35A Lightning IIs and a B-2 Spirit, honoring Air Force pilot Major Benjamin Chex Meyer. Major Meyer flew combat missions over Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. Per his wishes, upon his death in 2015, Major Meyer donated his heart, lungs, liver, and kidneys to save the lives of others. The B-2 came from Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, and the two F-35As came from Edwards Air Force Base in California. The flyover was conducted by Major Meyer's Air Force Squadron, and they flew the exact F-35A the Major flew on many of his missions. Business Wire reports that, quote, in a moving tribute, the F-35 on the left of the B-2 stealth bomber will represent all donors who have given the gift of life, while the F-35 on the right will symbolize all those who have received the gift of life. Brian captured a photograph of the flyover. You can find that in several related articles in the show notes. Also, if you search YouTube for 2018 Rose Parade Flyover, you'll find some amateur videos, and we'll put one of those in the show notes. I thought I'd tell you a little about the making of an Airplane Geeks episode. Some people are curious about that. If you are, here's your opportunity to peek behind the curtain. Each episode really begins with a show plan, a Google Doc, and it starts out as just a template with all the segments we might have in an episode. Over time, the plan fills out with topics and content for that episode. It's not a script, more like a roadmap. As you probably realize, we don't really know what anybody is going to say until they do. The key part of the show plan is the guest for the episode. We line up guests in advance. Sometimes we're booked out 6 weeks. Sometimes a lot less than that, but we don't like to scramble for a guest at the last minute. Brian identifies most of the guests and signs them up. This used to be a huge task for me, but Brian significantly eased my workload by taking this on. It actually takes a lot of time to contact potential guests, explain to them what this podcast thing is all about, wait for responses, sometimes work through the corporate or government communications department, schedule or reschedule guests, and explain why we want them on Skype instead of the telephone. Sometimes, however, the telephone is the only option. Brian gets guest bio and contact information. He conducts a Skype test with the guest in advance. Sometimes he can even persuade the guest to upgrade to a USB headset mic for better sound quality. As we get closer to our Monday evening recording time, everybody puts news stories into the show plan. We want to study them in advance and sometimes research the topic when we need to. At least that's the idea. The guests can see the show plan and even contribute news items or discussion topics themselves. Then, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we initiate a Skype call to all the co-hosts and the guest. We chat for a bit to get warmed up and for the guest to become familiar with us. Frankly, it's usually a less than totally serious conversation, and it's kind of a wonder some of the guests don't back out then. But when we do start recording the show, we get a bit more serious. This pre-show period also allows us to evaluate the Skype call quality. Sometimes we have to hang up and restart the call. Occasionally, we've had to pitch the whole thing and try another day, but that's pretty rare. On the technical side, everyone other than the guest is recording themselves locally. I'm doing that too, but also recording the entire Skype conversation with a digital audio recorder and in software as a backup. Usually all this redundancy is unnecessary, but occasionally it's saved an episode. Having the co-hosts record themselves also tends to eliminate the problem of Skype dropouts, which will show up in my recording of the entire call. Audio dropouts can be very annoying to deal with in post-production, and they are certainly annoying for you to listen to. Hardware here in the Airplane Geek studio is rather extensive. We have one laptop dedicated exclusively to Skype, runs nothing else. There's a microphone preamp, a mixer, the digital audio recorder, and a second laptop that's used for the show plan, any supporting documents and web pages, and for recording that backup copy in software. Also, pre-recorded segments are played from an old tablet that feeds the mixer and from there into Skype. I have several studio microphones, but I usually employ a condenser mic, except when there's a lot of noise outside, like children playing or lots of traffic or rain or cicadas in August. Then I use the dynamic mic, which is much less sensitive to those outside sounds. The co-hosts generally have pro-grade dynamic vocal mics, although sometimes a USB headset mic is pressed into service. Rob, I think, has a studio condenser. Then there is the mobile setup for group recording at events like at the National Air and Space Museum. And there's also a super compact recording kit that I use on the road in hotel rooms. Well, after we record the episode, everybody uploads their side, their recording, to Dropbox. I pull all the audio files into an audio editor, line up all the tracks, and then spend a day editing. Some editing is easy and obvious, like clipping off the pre-show and post-show banter and adding in the intro and outro music. Also, taking out parts where someone starts to say something, decides that's unintelligible, or they got lost and they start again. But there's a lot of other stuff to consider when editing a podcast episode. Basically, there are two extreme approaches to editing. One is creating the NPR-like experience where every sentence is on topic and perfect without vocal crutches like ums and you knows. There are no pregnant pauses or requests for clarification of the question being asked. The other extreme is a raw recording with no editing. It might be littered with those vocal crutches, or one co-host might ask the other, well, what should we talk about now? You might hear the fire department scream by outside or one of the children slamming the door. And you've probably heard both extremes on other podcasts. I like to edit somewhere in the middle, with the exception of going the extra mile to make the guest sound good. Not necessarily perfect, but good. Some guests are not used to talking into a mic, and they can sound a little rough, so I help them out a bit in the edit. Nevertheless, and this is actually fairly important, I don't change the message or the context, either spoken directly or implied. You might be surprised to learn just how much you can change the listener's impression of what someone said just by how you edit it. It's really made me wary of some of the clips you hear on the news. Now, you might wonder about the outtakes. Some people really like the outtakes. I even know a few listeners who start at the end to see if there are any outtakes. Are they real or manufactured? They are real. Mostly they come from the pre-show and post-show. I learned a long time ago to press record at the very start and press stop when the call ends, not before. There is a certain humor threshold for a clip to make it into the outtakes. I'll be honest, I've struggled through other podcasts, not aviation, where the bloopers are endless and boring. Hopefully that's not the case with us. Anyway, after the episode is finally edited or mixed, it's then mastered. See, audio engineering terminology creeps in. That means the loudness of the different speakers is leveled, equalization is applied to each voice to help make the sound clear and cut through noisy listening environments. Compression is applied to control the dynamic range, and sometimes noise removal is required, and there's an occasional de-essing. After all that, we turn the audio into an MP3 file, which has the appropriate tags applied, and then it's uploaded to our media host. This is a specialized service whose expertise is serving large audio files to thousands of listeners like you. But there's one more big job. The show notes for the episode post you see at airplanegeeks.com. It easily takes another hour or more to convert the show plan into the show notes you see on the website. Photos and other graphics need to be resized and uploaded. Links need to be checked, and the spelling and grammar needs to be at least pretty professional. With all that, it's finally time to press the publish button Wednesday morning. A few administrative tasks remain, like making the airplanegeeks.com/484 redirect for this episode, posting on Twitter and emailing the guest to let them know the episode is up. And then it's about time to start getting ready for the UAV Digest for the week, or the monthly PaxX podcast if it's a 3-episode week. Or I might even go see my lovely wife. Well, that's it for this Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Next time, we'll return to our usual format with aviation news from the past week, a great guest, some aviation history, your feedback, and more. Don't forget to visit the aviation events calendar at avgeekfests.com. Load in some of the 2018 events in your area that would be of interest to other AvGeeks, and feel free to share the avgeekfests.com link across your network. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode are at, of course, airplanegeeks.com/484. The website has links to us on social media, how to contact us, and how you can subscribe, as well as a donate button if you'd like to help support the show financially. It does cost money for media hosting, website hosting, and to keep our production values high. We appreciate the donations we have received, and the money goes into producing the podcast. We encourage you to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or through the podcast app you use on your mobile device. I'm fond of Pocket Casts, but a lot of people like Downcast, and there's Castro and Podcast Addict, Beyond Pod, Podbean, and many others. These all let you manage and play your podcast subscriptions. But if you'd like to go old-fashioned and want an email whenever a new episode is published, there's a very easy way to do that. Just simply visit subscribebyemail.com and type in Airplane Geeks. Then with each episode we publish, you'll receive an email that includes an embedded audio player. And actually, you can use subscribebyemail.com for just about any podcast. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. He creates these music compositions that incorporate aviation sounds. You can find those at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.